Welcome to the 21st. I'm Liz Westfield in for Nyla Boodoo.
You're watching WGN Midday News.
Chicago is making international headlines with its crime rate this summer, and the mayor and police superintendent want to change that.
WGN's Bob Jordan is live with their latest crime-fighting initiative. Bob?
Sharon Mack knows that living in her Inglewood neighborhood with crime and violence everywhere has made her a virtual prisoner in her home. She won't let her son play in the park just up the street because of trouble.
I have a four-year-old son, and I don't really want him outside. It's just too much going on. It's people shooting. They're shooting innocent people. It's drug dealers on every corner.
You just heard veteran journalist Robert Jordan reporting on one of the many stories of violent crime in the city of Chicago. But so many of these stories never get told. Often the ones we do hear about or want to hear about are the strange or the sensational. Why is that? How do news outlets decide which homicides to cover? And how do we decide which ones we care about? Almost five decades in the news business, many of which he spent as an anchor for WGN-TV, Robert Jordan tackles many of these tough questions in his new book, Murder in the News, An Inside Look at How Television Covers Crime. He's on the line with me now from his home outside Chicago. Bob, I want to welcome you to the 21st, and thanks so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me, Liz.
Of course. I look forward to this conversation as well. And I think listeners might be surprised to hear that it was actually your coverage of a political scandal that led to you writing this book about what drives murder coverage. So I know you share this story in the beginning of the book, but would you mind sharing it with us here today?
Sure, I'd be glad to. In 1995, I was sent from the station hurriedly down to cover the story of the indictment of Congressman Mel Reynolds. And when I got to his campaign headquarters on the South Side, there were all of my colleagues in minicam trucks and street reporters and still photographers and minicam operators all standing outside, a throng of reporters waiting to ambush him, not knowing if he was inside or out. And I joined the crowd, and we stood around and talked. And while I was there, I felt a tap on the shoulder. And there was this older black woman, probably in her 60s or so, who said, hello, Mr. Jordan, I'm so glad that you are here today covering the shooting of those three boys. And I said, well, I'm not sure I know what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. She said, yeah, those three boys who were shot yesterday. And I said, no, that's not why we're here. She said, well, what are you here for? And I said, we're here to cover the indictment of Congressman Mel Reynolds. And she said, oh, I can't believe that. Three of our boys were shot, and you're here for that? She said, you know, she looked at me for a moment and then punched me in the chest with her finger and said, I'm ashamed of you, and then turned and stormed off. Mm-hmm. And my colleagues heard that exchange, and one of them came over and said, you know, she's right. We should be. And I began thinking about why it is that we cover some stories and don't cover others. And when I began working on my dissertation, when I began working on the book, I sent out a questionnaire to assignment editors and producers at television stations here in Chicago and received a response based on these scenarios that I had sent to them. And the responses became chapter 4 of the book. And I began looking at why it is that we cover some stories mm-hmm. and don't cover others. And it basically boils down to the fact that we, as a society, believe that the lives of some people are more important than the lives of others.
Within your book, you also talk about the infamous police beating of Rodney King back in 1991. So that'd be 3 years before the story that you just shared. As a moment in time that made everyone step back a little bit and perhaps start to subconsciously question how certain topics were being covered versus those that weren't. And I'm curious, for you, was Rodney King a watershed moment or the beginning, at least, of one for TV coverage and this idea of sensationalism?
Liz, you are absolutely right. It was. I was in the story that morning that the video from L.A., from our sister station, KTLA, was being fed via satellite into all of the Tribune sister stations. And we were downloading that video via satellite. And I was standing there at the assignment desk watching this video come in.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember talking to one of the guys at the desk, and I said, you know, what is this? Is this some movie that they're shooting in Hollywood? And he said, no, this is supposedly a police beating. I said, no, can't be. Look at that. This guy's on the ground. Those are police officers. We didn't believe that anything like that could happen. And prior to that, news reporters and assignment editors and editors would generally take the word of public information officers and union leaders from the police department and others who would stand there and tell us that this is what happened, and we'd go with it. But once we saw that the Rodney King video was completely anathema to everything we had learned or had been accustomed to, it shook us up to the point where we said, and I began to think about the phone calls I had received from people who said, you know, I was beaten by police.
Yeah.
And I would think, you know, at the time, all these are just people who are disgruntled, and I consider that to be one of the darkest moments of my career, that I didn't at that time take the conversations that I heard about as being the truth, which later I found was the truth, that many of these people were telling me the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I turned around and I began investigating them then.
Well, and not to make light of that or sweep that under the rug, but I want to go back to a point you made in there about how when you're watching Rodney King, the video come down, and you're thinking, oh, well, this must be a movie, right? And today, the way in which we consume content and news, that would not be the first thing that would cross your mind these days. You wouldn't be as maybe shocked by it. Would you agree?
That you're absolutely right. I would not be today with the advent of cell phones and people having their own cameras, video began being captured all around of incidences where things like that were happening. We began to see that these incidences did take place because we could see them with our own eyes. The video wouldn't lie. And so it woke up society to a large degree, and those of us who were, so to speak, deniers had this epiphany saying, oh my goodness, this is true.
Well, and as you mentioned there too, with cell phones becoming a part of our day-to-day and the idea that you can record and capture anything in a moment's notice, how has technology, social media, the use of cell phones, the use of devices changed the news business, in your opinion?
I think it has changed it quite a bit. Today, television stations are broadcast television stations. In Chicago, we're looking at 257, 932, 26, and 44, as opposed to the cable stations, are really fighting over the scraps of an audience, because viewers today no longer tune in, wait to watch the news at 5, and 6, and 9.
Mm-hmm.
They record it. They watch it on their cell phones. They watch it on their tablets. They watch it on computers. So the over-the-air broadcast stations are fighting for the remaining audience. That's why you see so often breaking news, and they're trying to, you know, battle each other and grab the audience, and these agents who have come in from different, the consultants who have told news directors, you have to use breaking news because this captures your audience and makes people want to watch. Well, today, murders are the perfect breaking news story, because you don't have to go out in search of the other side. Everyone pretty well agrees that a murder is horrible.
Well, and I'm speaking with Bob Jordan, TV journalist and author of Murder in the News, and I really would like to get to this idea of breaking news as a term. For me, it has lost all meaning at this point. Everything is breaking news. I turn on the news, and that graphic is there, it seems, 24/7. And it seems to be a mainstay. It's not going anywhere. So what are your feelings on this idea of using that term, and how the idea of covering murder really falls under this idea of just nonstop breaking news all the time?
You know, I think you are typical of many viewers who have come to see breaking news, this breaking news banner, as fictitious.
Mm-hmm.
And the boy who cried wolf, because so many times stations will use breaking news or developing news, or developing story, for incidences that happened earlier in the day, just so that they can have that banner. And you're right. It's like 10 years ago when we began having live shots, and we would send reporters to the scene so that they could go live from a minicam truck. And it was a new toy. And people looked upon it as being pretty cool and pretty technologically great to be able to see that live. Today, we're accustomed to that. And you can even go live from your own cell phone with Periscope or with Facebook. So it's no big deal anymore. Yet, and you know, they still use this breaking news term. And I think as this pendulum swings back and forth, we'll see that go away.
Bob, in the book, you talk about the idea of good guys and bad guys. And when it's bad guys killing bad guys, no one wants to hear about it. And I imagine that this is very prevalent as far as Chicago media is concerned. Can you talk about this idea of good guys and bad guys and what you mean by that?
Sure. You know, I'll give you an example. If an assignment editor gets a crackling of the radio and a report comes in of a black teenager on the west side who's a gang member, a supposed gang member, who has been shot and killed, they may not send a crew to cover that because, you know, you've got so many other things to cover that day. But if you take that same black kid, put some school books under his arm, and have him walking to school when he's shot and killed, we'll have minicam trucks all over the neighborhood and helicopters in the sky. Same kid, same crime, different perspective. If you had a white female on Michigan Avenue shot and killed, we'd have helicopters in the sky.
Yeah.
But if you took that same white female and made her homeless and placed her in the uptown hillbilly neighborhood, she may slip through the cracks. It's because we feel that some people, when I say we, I mean all of society, looks upon some people as being more important than others. And when there are murders of politicians or prominent civic leaders or a big-time athlete or someone who's prominent as opposed to a homeless person or a gang member or someone else, the audience expects that we're going to go wall-to-wall, cover it with everyone we've got to make it team coverage and whatever it takes to do that story, as opposed to the others. And I've heard assignment editors say, you know, we'd have to have two or three dead to roll on it, you know, in some parts of town and not in others.
So building on that, there's 15-year-old Hydea Pendleton, who was killed in 2015. And that murder got a lot of attention. But others that happened on that very same day, or even around that time, did not. How do you account for that?
Because we don't get to know about every crime that occurs. Even though there have been attempts to try and cover every murder, just some you just don't hear about. But you know, in the cases of shootings in the park and things of that nature, when police have been alerted, the assignment editors will hear about it. But in the case of Hydea Pendleton, there were two other murders that same night. And I spoke with the sister whose brother was shot and killed. And his name was Gino. And she said, you know, I don't begrudge the Pendleton family for having a $40,000 reward and Michelle Obama. But let me back up for a moment. In the case of Hydea Pendleton, that case was almost ignored as well. But her mother and father would not let it go. They called stations and they talked to reporters and they said, our daughter was not a gang member. Our daughter was a good girl. She was an honor student. And she marched in the parade for President Barack Obama for his inauguration. Well, that changed the whole complexion of the importance of her story, of her death. And all of a sudden, it became big-time news. And Michelle Obama came to her funeral, and the governor, and the mayor, and all the civic leaders, and you couldn't get in the church. And when Gino was shot and killed, his sister said, you know, the people who shot my brother are still walking the streets because pressure was not put upon them with the bigger reward and the pressure from City Hall to get it solved. And so, therefore, she's not getting the justification that the Pendleton family did.
Well, Bob, we just have about a minute left. So I was curious, what do you want people watching TV news to know when they see a sensational story? And what should they be asking themselves while they watch it?
I think that they should use emails, write the news directors and the managers of the stations and the editors at the newspaper, because that does make a difference.
Okay.
And I'd like to see the TV stations cycle their inside people out more so that they have a chance to see and talk to people in neighborhoods and come away understanding that, you know, everyone in these crime-ridden neighborhoods are not bad. It's just a very small number of people, and so they shouldn't be neglected as they are many times.
We've been talking to veteran TV news anchor and reporter Robert Jordan about his new book, Murder in the News, an inside look at how television covers crime. Bob, I want to thank you so much for joining us here on the 21st today.
Thank you so much, Liz. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Liz Westfield in for Nyla Boodoo. Candy Crush, Pokemon Go, Geometry Dash, with tens of thousands of apps out there, how do we know which ones are right for our kids? And should children even be using apps in the first place? Freelance health and science journalist Tara Haley is on the line from Peoria. She recently wrote about this very issue for the New York Times. Tara, I want to welcome you back to The 21st.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And with all these apps, we wondered, what happened to good old-fashioned toys? Do kids still care about toys that don't include a screen? And along those device-free lines, what should we be looking for at the toy store? Kathy Stickles is the toy manager and buyer at the Art Mart Toy Store here in Champaign. She's also on the line. Kathy, welcome to the 21st show for the very first time.
Thanks for having me.
So Kathy, Tara, we need advice from both of you, especially as we're shopping for toys this season and we're doing a lot of holiday travel with children and tablet in tow. But Tara, I want to start with you. There are thousands of new apps aimed at kids out there. So how do we know if an app is appropriate for children?
Well, there's a couple of different things you can look for when you're assessing the app. And I'll give you the short answer and the long answer.
Okay.
You can cut me off on the long one. The short answer is go to Common Sense Media and look at their reviews, because Common Sense Media is a nonprofit that's their entire purpose is to review all different kinds of media for kids.
Okay.
And I rely on them pretty heavily. I'll go there and check things out. But if it's not something they've reviewed yet, or it's something that you're sitting there in the car and the kid's, yelling at you right then, and you just want to grab the phone and look at the app, I would say look for advertising. Is there a lot of advertising in there? Because you want to be conscientious of what kind of advertising your child is being exposed to, and you want to see if there are in-app purchases. So I would look at those kind of things. And then if you have a little more time, you want to go to their website and investigate their privacy policy.
Okay.
And then if they're making educational claims, it depends on if it's for fun or it's education. If it's for fun, then you can kind of just look at those things there. If it's for educational purposes, look for evidence of the actual educational value that they're proposing. You should be looking at what they're, on their website, they should have something that explains why and how it's educational. And that's where places like Common Sense Media can really help guide you in choosing apps for educational reasons.
Yeah, and I'm glad that you made the distinction there between an educational app versus an app that's a little bit more aimed just for fun and for them just having a general good time. And with the Common Sense Media, I'm curious, are there ways in which parents can talk to one another about their experiences? Are there actual individual reviews, or is it just a company reviewing those apps?
They have a panel of people who do these reviews who have a background in education and in technology. So they know they have very specific criteria they're looking for, and they're very transparent about that criteria. What I really like about it is that they break down exactly what the different aspects of the app that they're reviewing, because one app might be really great in terms of its educational value, but they'll note that, yeah, it does have advertising. So if you don't want your kids seeing an ad for Cocoa Puffs, then even though it's educational, you might not want this app. So they'll actually separate those things out, which is really nice.
Yeah, that is really nice. So, Kathy, let's talk tactile toys. You're the toy store manager and toy buyer at the Art Mart here in Champaign. So you actually get to decide which toys make their way onto your shelves. So I'm very curious if we could take a step into your mind here for a second. What goes into that process for you, and what do you look for?
Well, first of all, I'm a mom. I have three children. They range in age from 13 to 20, so they're a little bit older now. And I also used to be a teacher. I taught for 10 years. So I kind of have a mom hat and a teacher hat when I'm looking at toys and books. And it doesn't mean that everything I have in the toy store needs to be educational necessarily, but I like to have something that I feel is unique, special, it has quality, and kind of promotes creativity in some way. Those are sort of the parameters that I look for. Is that a toy or a book that maybe I wouldn't see in the mass market? Is that something that is just really going to kind of stand apart from?
Well, Kathy, I'm actually kind of curious. What would you define as unique or special in that process, or excuse me, in those toys?
When I say unique or special, it doesn't have to be something that is completely innovative or new.
Okay.
It can be classic. It can be a classic toy, like a dollhouse or blocks or, a classic game. But it's something that promotes creativity. It is something that I feel that is not, made of maybe plastic and requires a lot of batteries and flashing lights, or something that you're going to see, 200 of if you go to a big box store. It's something that, is going to keep a child engaged and interested and playing with for a while. And well, parents or siblings, they're going to want to play with it too.
Well, and I'm curious, Kathy, you're talking a lot about these more traditional classic type toys. Mm-hmm. Are you still finding that those are popular not only with parents, but the kids that the toy is being purchased for?
Very much so. I find people come into the toy store and they're still interested in looking at board games and puzzles, dollhouses, blocks, some of those classic traditional toys that we grew up with or parents or grandparents grew up with. In fact, books are some of our biggest sellers. And people, I would say, 10 years ago thought that books might have been on the way out being replaced by a tablet. But that's really not the case as far as children's books go. People are craving children's books that you have that experience of putting a child on, your lap and you're reading aloud and holding the book with them. And we sell so many children's books.
Well, that certainly makes my heart happy.
Yes, yeah, it makes my heart happy too. But we really do, we sell a lot of those classic toys, as well as some new toys, that have kind of an innovative design as well.
Well, and Tara, we know that you can go for classic toys, but at the end of the day, especially when you're looking at a long car trip, for example, apps are going to play a role in that. Tablets are probably going to play a role in that. So when we do have more time off or more time in the car and they're spending more time in front of the screen, how do you make sure that they're doing so safely, especially while unsupervised? So if you're thinking about the fact that you're driving, you don't have immediate safe access to reach back there, perhaps. So think about these stories where kids are making in-app purchases or charges of thousands of dollars without parents knowing right away. How can you make sure that they are interacting with those apps and that device as safely as possible?
Definitely. And as someone who will be driving to Texas for the fourth time this year, I
got a speed, by the way.
Yeah. So we have a couple of Kindles and an iPad that my kids often use in the car and in the plane. And one thing that we do is we make sure that we activate the parental controls on the device itself. Most devices, especially ones like the Kindles that are made for kids, there are certain Kindles that are made just for kids. We have a Kindle Fire. They have very specific parental controls that you can activate that prevent the kids from doing different things, such as making in-app purchases. And then another thing is to look at the app itself to see whether it allows you to make a purchase, for example, without a password. Like whenever I'm a Pokemon Go player, so is my 72-year-old mother and my 7-year-old son. So
love
we all bond over Pokemon Go. And Pokemon Go, every time we want to purchase coins in there, it requires a password entry. So my son can't purchase any coins on his own unless he knows my password. So that's another thing to look at. And in general, I should have mentioned this before, but always look at who makes the app in the first place.
Okay.
It's kind of like any kind of assessment of anything that you're looking at. What's the source? Who's the source? Anything from, you know, the creators of Sesame Street, for example, honestly, they're going to have vetted everything and you're golden. Whereas if it's a new startup, that doesn't mean you shouldn't trust it, but it means you should do a little bit more research into the app itself before just automatically handing it over to your child. I would also work in breaks. Make sure that they're not spending the entire, you know, it's a 15-hour drive sometimes to Texas,
mm-hmm.
and they're not on that device for 15 hours. So we institute breaks. We've set timers. We go to, you know, stop at rest stops. And we also ask them questions. Kids learn the best when they engage, and that's no different with devices. So even if you're driving or maybe you're in the passenger seat, you can ask them what they're doing. Or you can say, you know, my son plays Minecraft. What did you just build in Minecraft? Or what's your biggest obstacle right now? So engaging with them in that is also very helpful.
Well, and sharing the experience. So I like how you mentioned Pokemon Go, that you guys all play it across all generations, and that connects you mm-hmm. to grandma or to your child. And I like that idea. And also, I'm hearing that we'd like to know what team you're on in Pokemon Go.
Mystic all the way.
I will pretend to know what that means and give you a big old thumbs up. I got to be honest.
Mystic are the smart ones.
Okay. Well, Tara, I wanted to expand this idea of knowing where those apps come from, knowing what they're doing with it, but also knowing what they're doing with the user data. It's a concern for all of us who use the web and social media and interact with the outside world via a device. Should adults be concerned about privacy for children while using some of these apps, and how can they mitigate some of that or just be smart about it?
Absolutely. That's one of the most important things you should be looking at, because children today they might realize all the benefits and the fun of being online, but they're not aware of how serious the privacy issues are, like we are. And one thing that you can do is see if the app is designed specifically for children under age 13. The reason 13 is a magic number is that if the app is explicitly designed for a child under age 13, it's federally required to be compliant with the Children's Online Privacy Protection Rule. And if people want to read more on that, you could just Google COPPA, C-O-P-P-A, to read more about that. So if they say that they're COPPA compliant in the app description,
mm-hmm.
that's a good sign. That's
okay.
What you want to see. If it's for older kids, then it gets a little bit more challenging, and you'd want to assess it the same way you might assess anything for yourself.
That's smart. Absolutely. And Kathy, I want to switch back to, quote, traditional toys, or just toys that you physically interact with. I'm very curious, especially this particular holiday shopping season, what are you seeing flying off the shelves? Give us a couple examples.
You know, the past couple of years, and I'm sure this is no surprise, but Lego-type building toys.
Oh, yeah.
That's really the hot toy. But then kind of stemming from that, also just building toys in general. Any type of building toy that we seem to stock in the toy store really seems to fly. It's something that appeals to boys and girls, multiple ages. I think moms and dads enjoy getting in there and building with their children as well. So especially the Magnetiles, that's a toy we've sold for years. But,
love those.
It's become even more popular the past couple of years. People just really seem to love it. They're these magnetic tiles that are different shapes, geometric shapes, and you piece them together, and people are just crazy about it. So,
and you can build stuff together.
Yeah, building toys really seem huge, and games. Again, that's something that's always been a popular holiday gift, but games really the past year or two have just become even more popular, it seems. People come in and they want to know what is a great family game.
Mm-hmm.
I think people are spending more time playing games as a family now.
Well, and that's one of the, in my opinion, greatest benefits of a physical toy and giving one of those to a child in your life, is that there's this sense that you can interact with it together. There's teamwork, mm-hmm. there's collaboration, there's conversation, there's connection, especially, definitely. You know, when you're building something and you see it come to life, whether that be with Legos or those magnetic pieces, that's really great. So Tara, I'm kind of curious, outside of perhaps your Pokemon Go example, are there ways that apps can provide that same degree of teamwork, collaboration, and connection with your kids?
Absolutely. In fact, I had to restrain myself from not jumping in when you listed all those C words, collaboration, cooperation. Those are exactly what you want to look for in an app as well. The basic learning principles for children and adults, for that matter, don't really change across media, whether it's physical, in your hand kind of object, or it's books, or it's an app. It's about collaboration, interaction, mm-hmm. something called scaffolding, which means that it builds on your previous learning. It takes something you've already learned and adds something new that connects to it, kind of like a chain link fence, perhaps. All of those are things that you can do, and it makes all of it richer when you are actually sitting there with your child. A lot of us tend to think, okay, well, I can just hand them the iPad and now I can go make dinner.
Right.
And I won't deny that I've done that. I think all of us have at some point. But it's also really valuable to sit down next to your child with the app and explore a new app together. Or sometimes there's apps where you can both be playing together or answering questions together. There's all different kinds of books that you can read, and the books that have questions throughout, where maybe you read a chapter and then a question pops up in the corner for you to discuss.
Oh, okay.
So those are actually the exact kind of things that you want to look for in an app if your goal is education. It's true with games as well, but I think if most of the time you're looking at educational apps when you're looking at those things. And there is no substitute for human interaction.
Of course.
It doesn't matter whether it's a physical board game, whether it's Legos, which is half of my son's Christmas list. in fact, sometimes you can even have cross interests. Since my son won't be listening to this, I think I can safely say that I bought him 5 Minecraft books. Because we want him to read, and he loves Minecraft.
So, right, so it's a good way to marry the two, right?
Exactly.
Well, very quickly, just a few seconds to each of you, and I know this is going to be hard to do. If you had a top pick for the toy for you, Kathy, or the app for you, Tara, what would you choose as a suggestion? We'll go to Kathy first.
Well, I already mentioned it before, Magnetiles. That is something that is a toy that children come in, and we have a set out in the toy store, and they will build these fantastic towers and creations, and it just blows my mind. And it's something people come back for again and again, and that's probably my favorite toy in the toy store. So any type of building toy like that, and you can get the whole family involved, that's my favorite toy, really.
Perfect. And Tara, what would your suggestion be?
I'm going to cheat and say it's a whole suite of apps.
Okay.
The TinyBop apps. TinyBop, TinyBop, and they are so cool. They're educational and fun. There's ones like Skyscrapers, which is building, the Earth, Robot Factory, Space, the Human Body, and you get to do things like actually go inside the body and see the heart pumping and work and explore the arteries, and it's just really cool, and I'm a science nerd, so I'm all over those.
That's Peoria-based health and science journalist Tara Haley, along with Kathy Stickles, who oversees the toy section at Art Mart in Champaign. I want to thank you both for joining us here on the 21st today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
May the Force be with you. We're talking Star Wars next on the 21st, so you want to stay tuned. Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. I'm Liz Westfield in for Nyla Boodoo. Need I say more? Star Wars Episode 8, The Last Jedi, is now out in theaters, and it's a pretty popular movie franchise, to say the least. From when it was first launched back in the late 70s to today in 2017, Star Wars continues to capture the imagination of millions, both here in the U.S. and around the world. And we want to talk about this latest installment in the franchise, of course, but also about what role Star Wars has played in the lives of so many people. Keith Phipps is the editorial director of film and television for UpRocks. I'm also joined by Brian Troyan. He's the public relations officer for what's called the 501st Legion. We'll get to that in a minute. Keith and Brian, welcome to the 21st.
Hi,
pleasure to be here.
So I am curious what it was about Star Wars that originally spoke to each of you as fans. So I want to start with Keith and then we'll go to Brian.
Oh, gosh. Well, I saw when I was four. You know, I saw the original one in theaters when I was four. And it's, I think at a certain age, the right movie can kind of rewire your brain, and that sort of kind of took over my imagination for the next, the rest of my childhood. And kind of, it's not like I realized at one point that there probably hasn't been a day since then that I haven't thought about Star Wars at least a little bit, and mm-hmm. often more than that. So, yeah, it's kind of been with me most of my life.
How about you, Brian?
I'd have to echo Keith's sentiments. I'm a little bit behind him. I think I was one when the first movie came out, and it's been part of my life as long as I can remember. Some of my favorite childhood memories are playing with the action figures with my brother and racing my bike down the street pretending that I'm on the forest moon of Endor or what have you. And I was a fan straight through. There hasn't been a lull, although there wasn't Star Wars everywhere like there is
right.
today back
Absolutely.
In the 90s. I was one of those standard bearers that kept the fandom alive during the dark times.
You kept the fires burning, so to speak.
Absolutely.
Looking to the newest generation of Star Wars fans, what do you believe they're connecting with most? So again, I'll go with Keith first on this one.
Well, most immediately in our household, our six-year-old is connecting with the Porgs. There's a lot of excitement over these Porgs.
Mm-hmm.
There's that. But, I mean, the next generation of fans, I think there's just a lot. There's something for any, people for any age to latch on to with this. But by next generation, if you mean like the kids right now, I've mm-hmm. watched my daughter become a fan. And I think this new series has just done a really great job of staying true to the tradition of what came before, but also making it very easy for someone to jump right in with these very exciting new characters, which in the new movie, I think, are even more firmly established as worthwhile Star Wars characters in their own right.
Well, and a strong female lead, not that Leia wasn't, but I'm in love with Rey in every sense of fandom. But Brian, to you, anything you'd like to add for the new generation of Star Wars fans?
I think Star Wars is one of those things that taps into a collective unconsciousness in everyone. There's something mythological about it that new generations, old generations, anyone can connect with, especially the iconic characters. In my experience, I'm seeing a lot of kids dressed up as stormtroopers and Rey and Kylo Ren, and it's great to see a whole new generation of fans, the third or the fourth generation of Star Wars fans, latching on to these heroes and villains.
Absolutely, and I definitely want to talk to you more about this idea of cosplay and costumes here in just a moment. But Keith, first I want to explore with you this idea of spoiler culture. So whether or not someone considers themselves a Star Wars fan, chances are they still have a basic idea of what's going on within the canon, or at least this latest trilogy. So do you think it's still possible to experience blockbuster movies free of any preconceived notions, opinions, theories, or spoilers?
I think it's good to try. I mean, it's sort of, nature of my business to be spoiled on things if it's sort of somewhat unavoidable. But I was talking to Mike Ryan, who's a writer for our site, and one thing that's interesting about this movie is how little has leaked out. I mean, J.J. Abrams is famously, a secret keeper and mm-hmm. loves his mystery boxes, but a lot of The Force Awakens plot had kind of gone public before the film came out, and I went into this knowing very little. And I think that people are going to be quite surprised by some of the plot developments. So it was kind of a thrill to watch a Star Wars movie where I really had no idea what was going to happen next. And that's both because I just didn't know because I hadn't been spoiled, but also Rian Johnson does a really great job of moving this in directions that you're not going to expect.
Ooh, I'm excited. Brian, so I want a chance to, or I want to give you a chance to explain what the 501st Legion is, why and how it was created, and just how big the organization spans.
Well, the 501st Legion started back in 1997 as just a group of folks who had stormtrooper costumes getting together and saying, hey, isn't this cool? Alban Johnson and his friend Tom Cruise, not that Tom Cruise, a different Tom Cruise, both built their own fan-made stormtrooper armor and decided to have it finished and debut it for the release of Star Wars Special Edition. And they went out to a movie theater, just suited up and walked around, and people went crazy for it. So a few months later, at Dragon Con, they got together with some other people who had stormtrooper outfits from all over the United States, and they made a big splash at this big costuming convention mm-hmm. in Atlanta. And from there, it snowballed. Today, we've got more than 12,000 members worldwide dedicated to wow. recreating the villains of the Star Wars saga. So what we do is we suit up in our bad guy costumes, and we go out and show them off, spread the love of Star Wars at hospitals, charity walks, birthday parties sometimes, movie premieres, of course, comic conventions. And we've built a really tight community around the world based around a mutual love of the saga.
Well, and I love that you guys essentially went viral before we had any idea what going viral meant or what it looked like. So as I'm to understand, and I think you might have briefly mentioned there, it's an all-volunteer organization, including yourself. So what first inspired you to volunteer your time and to get involved and be a part of this organization?
Well, I ran into them at Wizard World Chicago in 1999, I want to say. And at that point, the club was very much in its nascent years. We're now 20 years old, celebrating our 20th anniversary this year. And I think that what drew me in was that I'd always wanted to be a stormtrooper. You know, like I mentioned before, riding my bicycle around the neighborhood in 1983, I just imagined that I was a biker scout and that I was chasing down rebels. And so when I met someone through another costuming organization who was part of the 501st and got to talking, he set me up with a kit. And it was a very black market kind of a situation because it was fan-made and unlicensed. And I got a big brown box, and it sat in my garage for the better part of 4 or 5 years until I finally, my wife and I had a Halloween costume party coming up, and she said, are you ever going to build this thing? I said, yeah, I guess I will. But what really spurred me to it was reading about something that the Midwest Garrison, the local 501st chapter here in Illinois, had done for a boy named Max Lacewell. Max was terminally ill, but he loved Star Wars, and they set up what has come to be known as the best day ever for him. It was a giant Star Wars party where he got to duel Darth Maul, which was his dream, and reading about how people were able to take their love of Star Wars and a hobby and make a real difference in Max's life and in the lives of his family members. It really moved me. This is something that I can do, that I can have fun with and make a difference. And how many people can say that their hobby can do that?
And I want to come back to not only you being drawn to the dark side, but a little bit more about the 501st costumes and the time and effort you put into it. But Keith, counting The Last Jedi, we're looking at least 7 more Star Wars films guaranteed. There are rumors that there could be somewhere around, I don't know, possibly 20 films before we're all said and done with what's currently happening. But with the ever-growing popularity of, say, superhero movie franchises, for example, is there franchise/attention competition out there? And do you see the excitement for Star Wars burning out anytime soon?
To answer the last question first, no, I really don't. I mean, as long as the quality, if they keep the quality up, I think that people are going to keep turning out for these. And I don't necessarily see it as competition. I really do think that the Marvel model kind of helped show the way for how Star Wars could be revived and, you know, have sort of these sort of this expanded universe to maybe not the right term, but sort of this larger cinematic universe and some parts would be parts of the actual saga and some would be spin-off films and you can keep going. And like, it sounded like it kind of risked burning them out, but I did really like Rogue One. I think it kind of showed that you could have different types of Star Wars films mm-hmm. outside of the sort of canonical trilogy ones. So I think, you know, as long as they're good, people are going to keep coming. It's an exciting world to visit. And so far the films have been quite good.
And getting into more of the cultural impacts, going back to the original trilogy and looking at this current trilogy, what do you believe Star Wars' most significant impact has been on, or impacts, on modern pop culture or movie making in general? I know you're kind of hitting on the movie making part a little bit, but what about the grander pop culture conversation?
I mean, there's sort of like easy things to latch on to. It's, you know, the one, you know, the really easy one, which I never really buy, is it sort of allowed for some more escapist entertainment after the feel-bad years of the Watergate era and the films that accompanied it. And they kind of get blamed for erasing some of the more thoughtful films of the 70s. I don't necessarily buy that. I think there's a lot more to them than that, and it kind of simplifies things. But if there's any films most responsible for filmmaking becoming, for better or for worse, you know, bigger and grander and blockbustery, it's definitely the Star Wars films. But I also think on a less, you know, commercial level, just these, you know, you're talking to two people now, and you're one of them as well. I'm sure these stories get under your skin and mm-hmm. stay with you. They become these kind of modern myths that you kind of look to as a shared frame of reference. That there's not too many people that won't get who you're talking about. If you're talking about at least Luke Skywalker, even if they can't necessarily trade deep trivia with you about Star Wars, it's just part of the fabric of our world right now.
Well, and Brian, expanding on that idea, what role do you see your organization, the 501st, and others like it playing in that larger cultural conversation and impact that it has on the fans and the viewers?
I think what the 501st does is give us an opportunity to manifest extreme fandom, bringing the saga to life and bringing it down to the public in a very tangible, you can reach out and touch us kind of way. Mm-hmm. And that's never more prevalent than when you're in front of a kid who's looking up at Darth Vader himself. The breathing is going
in
on.
In awe and fear, maybe.
Exactly. Sometimes. But we try to minimize that by being your friendly neighborhood stormtroopers.
Well, and actually speaking to the impressive nature of your costumes, because I have seen them firsthand, I believe you guys were out at the Force Awakens premiere when I went out to see the movie. Is it true mm-hmm. that you got recognized by Lucasfilms for the quality of your Star Wars costumes?
Yes, Lucasfilm has recognized us as the premier Imperial costuming organization in the world. And when it comes to Star Wars costuming, there's one name that's at the top of the heap, and that's the 501st Legion. They do come to us with partnerships when it comes to promotions. Often when you see stormtroopers out there in the public, they are us. Sometimes Disney has their own actors, but for example, at the Bears game a few months ago, when the trailer for The Last Jedi came out, some of those stormtroopers out on Soldier Field were our members.
So I wish I could continue this conversation for many more minutes, perhaps many more hours, but that is sadly all we have for today. I do have one last question for each of you. So I'm going to go with Brian first, then we'll go over to Keith. So who shot first, Han Solo or Greedo?
Han shot first.
I imagine Keith is also going to echo your sentiments there.
Oh, it has to be Han. we can go on for many more minutes as to why it has to be Han, but yeah, it has to be Han.
Exactly. Keith Phipps and also Brian Troyan, you guys have been amazing to talk Star Wars with, so thanks so much for joining us here on the 21st today.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having us.
That That's all the time we have for today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. We're also available on iTunes and Android. We're produced by Robin Lin and Alan Montecilio. Libby Foster is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. I'm Liz Westfield, in for Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.